Good evening, everybody. Let's get into the Word. We'll be in Genesis chapter 32 this evening. Genesis 32. It's hard for us to really plug in sometimes to the drama that occurred in the lives of the people, especially the patriarchs, because we tend to airbrush their lives. I think we do that with a lot of people we don't know. We airbrush people's lives. We sort of brush off the rough edges and imagine things. Imagine that their life is like vastly different than ours and not nearly as stressful. Or see their stresses. This is, I think, what we do more often. We see their stresses in light of the end of what happened to them afterward. And since we know how the story turns out, when we read the accounts of the people in the Scriptures, and a lot of times we read the accounts of other people, faithful people through history, we water down the emotional trauma. We don't mean to. We're not purposely doing this. But we don't really relive the trauma like we're living the trauma in our own lives. And of course, the difference is we can read the end of theirs and we cannot read the end of ours. But that's why God gave us their accounts. The reason, according to the Apostle Paul, for the entire Old Testament is to teach us how to think. It was written and it was experienced by those people so that we could see the end from the beginning and so that we would realize there is an end to what we are doing as well. We read the end of their story. We say, look, it turned out okay. We then kind of imagine to ourselves that they didn't go through as much stress as we happen to be in right this minute. What he wants us to do is say, look, they're going through just as much stress, maybe more than I went through, and it turned out all right. And because I know the end of their story, and because I also believe in the Lord, I know that somehow my story will also turn out all right. That's what he wants us to learn. Because you see, the lessons of faith are the same generation after generation after generation. God says, this is my track record, but I'm not telling you the future. He says, instead, I'm going to tell you other people's past who have trusted me. And then I'm going to ask you if you'll trust me today and tomorrow and the next day. That's the way it works. As we enter into Jacob's life, we're in the patriarchs in the book of Genesis, and we get into Jacob's life, and we're in the section where he's making a huge, huge life transition. Hard for us to grasp just how big the decision was for him to leave Paddan Aram. When he was younger, 70, and he went to Paddan Aram, the decision was sort of made for him by Esau, who wanted to kill him. And that really motivates you. When somebody's trying to kill you, it's easy to figure, maybe God wants me to leave. And everything kind of was laid out for him. But it's interesting, after 20 years, and 20 years is a long time in the same place, 20 years of developing family, he's now got 11 kids, four wives, well, two wives and two concubines, and innumerable cattle and sheep and servants. He is a small nation, this man Jacob. After 20 years, his life has gotten really, really big. A big, big life that he's got now. Moving this big, big life takes, well, it takes an act of God. And that's exactly what it was. And it would have felt like a tectonic shift to him. His whole life was changing. Interesting how that happens. It doesn't happen a lot in life, but it can happen two, three times at least in a full-length human life. Your life can go through absolutely drastic, radical, powerful changes. And in those times is when the Lord very often becomes very clear, but not very easily. As long as life is cruising along in Paddan Aram, or before that, for 70 years back in Canaan, it seemed like, well, you know, tomorrow will be pretty much like today. But then those moments come when the trauma and the change and everything happens. It either caves in or changes or moves, and all of a sudden you cry out to God and you say, Lord, where are you? Well, that's where Jacob is when we get into chapter 32 of Genesis. As a matter of fact, he's kind of been there in the last chapter as well, because God spoke to him and said, it's time for you to leave. Now, we don't know, leave Paddan Aram, leave Uncle Laban, who was, I don't think there were a lot of tears to be shed about leaving Uncle Laban, but And I don't know whether it was Jacob's original desire to leave because he saw things getting tough, getting kind of bad there at Paddan Aram, or whether the Lord spoke to him first and then things got tough. I don't know. But I do know this. God slowly, it didn't happen overnight, but he slowly convinced Jacob that it was time for him to leave Paddan Aram. And Jacob made the move while Uncle Laban was 3 days away shearing the sheep. He was out on a business trip, and Jacob knew that Laban was such a hardcore guy that he would try and stop him by force. And we saw that last time we got together. And Laban would have tried to stop him by force from leaving. So Jacob snuck away. Whether he was right or wrong, we don't know. We didn't pass judgment on all of what he did, but he did sneak away. And then he had this awesome interaction with Laban when Laban caught up with him. You remember the whole thing. Well, he's fresh from that now. He's right in the process of changing his whole life. He's got his entire life with him, and it's a great big one. He's just come out of the trauma of leaving Paddan Aram. He's on his way to Canaan, and as he moves toward Canaan, he realizes he has another major challenge to face. In fact, I'm sure he had never forgotten this. He knew that if he went back to Canaan, he was going to have to face brother Esau after 20 years. And the last time he saw Esau, Esau said, I'm going to kill you. If I see you again, I am going to kill you because you took my birthright and you took everything. And that's when Jacob had left. So now he knows he's going to have to go back and deal with Esau. They had not spoken. They had not sent letters back and forth. They had not done any email. They had not been on the phone. They had not had any contact for 20 years. And people have a way of holding grudges. Jacob certainly would have. Jacob would have held a grudge, I think. I don't think that Jacob was such a mature man of God that he would have said, well, let's let bygones be bygones. Had it been the other way around, had it been Esau who had cheated Jacob, I'm not sure Jacob would have let bygones be bygones. And I think that's pretty clear if you know the story, because Jacob fully expects Esau to try and kill him still after 20 years. I think that's an indicator that Jacob himself might have felt the same way. We tend to project on other people, don't we? So he knows he has to face him, and this is occupying his mind. By the way, nobody knows, do they, or very few people know the situations in your life that you have to face again. They don't know. Maybe even the people closest to you do not know that there is an Esau out there somewhere. And the chances are that you may have to deal with that person or that situation again before God is finished working with you. If that is the case, if there's something in your life that is truly unfinished business, and there's no question that's the way Esau was. Esau was unfinished business that was Jacob's fault, and his relationship with Esau needed to be dealt with. I don't know what your situation may be. But I do know that we have them. People with big lives also have a lot of complexity. And they have things they hide from everybody else. But they can't hide them from the Lord. And I want you to see how the Lord brings Jacob graciously and yet not without some wounding to coming to the situation of resolving that thing with Esau. Because it's God's plan not to hurt but to resolve it. And I want to encourage you, if you know the Lord is saying, deal with this, it may be from 20 or 30 or 40 years ago or more in your life, but if he's saying deal with it, and you can see that in order to go forward with God, you're going to have to go back to this situation and deal with it, then may I offer you a little bit of encouragement? You're not the first one to have to do that, and God very often turns us around and makes us deal with stuff that we've left alone for many, many years. It's okay to do that. In fact, very often, in order to get back into the promised land, back into the point of blessing, the Lord says, on your way back there, we need to talk about this, and you need to deal with, and then you fill in the blank. If that's a situation in your life, trust that it's from God, and ask him what you ought to do about it. That's what Jacob's doing, and boy, it is on his mind. As he approaches a place called the Jabbok, which is a kind of a creek, and when he crosses that creek, he's back in the general vicinity of Canaan. It's on the east of the Jordan River. But it would still have been considered back in somewhat in home territory again. And so he's coming up to a very, very major, major point. Chapter 32, verse 1. Now as Jacob went on his way, the angels of God met him. And Jacob said when he saw them, "Ah, this is God's camp." So he named the place Mahanaim. We have a youth camp we call Camp Mahanaim. And it's because this actually means two camps. But we named it Mahanaim because of the story, not just because of the meaning of the Hebrew word. The story involves Jacob realizing, we have a camp. I have my own camp here, but there's also another camp. God's camp is actually, the angels are camped here as well, where we are. And that's why we named that youth camp Camp Mahanaim, because we discovered that too. And you know something? It's interesting that as Jacob approaches this huge trial, he gets a vision, an angelic vision, right in the very beginning of it. It sort of ends, this particular chapter ends also with another dealing with an angel, not quite visionary, as a matter of fact, very physical and very real. But it starts, notice, chapter 32 starts with an angelic vision. I wish we knew more, don't you? I mean, it just says he saw a bunch of angels. In fact, it so impressed him, he named the place Mahanaim. Two camps is what it means. God's camp and our camp. I wish that we would get in there and say, well, what happened? Did they talk to you? How many did you see? What did they look like? Wow, this is really cool. And it's not the first time it's happened to Jacob. And there have always been surprises. Incidentally, Jacob never went out and said, I got to go see an angel or I'm just not going to be able to get through the day. He didn't do that. These things happen by accident. Isn't that stupid? That is terrible. Not by accident, but not because Jacob was doing anything except doing what he was told, and an angelic vision came to him. The Lord showed him some angels. You know, I think we vastly underestimate both the power and the presence of the angelic around us. Now, some people I know, there is such a thing as the angel fetish, truly. There is an idolatry about angels today in some circles, and almost a worshiping of angels that is not Christian. By the way, a lot of the angelology in our culture is not Christian. It's strictly spiritism. It's very New Age, and it's kind of dangerous, actually, in that sense. And yet, but on the other hand, we need to remember angels are real, and the only reason we can't see them is very simply because God hasn't allowed us to see them. And it is a perfectly legitimate prayer for you to pray on a regular basis, Lord, put your angels around me or around my family. I pray that all the time. I pray it for this church every day, that there will be angelic protection, not around the building, but around you. Maybe I should pray for the building. We've had some things stolen and broken from time to time. Maybe we should add that. The angels are really there. And when we pray to our Heavenly Father, He really does dispatch angels to do things. It is true all the way through the Scriptures. And the only thing stopping us from seeing them is very simply He doesn't allow us to. If we could see them, do you know how useless we would be here on earth if we actually could see the angels? He doesn't want us. He wants us to live by faith, but He gives us plenty of glimpses of them in His Word, and He says, trust me, they are there. If you've forgotten that there are, and you say, well, do I have a guardian angel? I don't know. My personal conviction is you probably do, but we joke about it so much that it becomes something sort of unreal to us. Now, don't let that happen. Angels are real, and God uses them. He sends them. They are His messengers, and they're incredibly powerful creatures. When Elisha was surrounded by Naaman the Syrian, who had come there, and Gehazi, Elisha's little sidekick, went out to get the morning paper. Do you remember the story? It's in 2 Kings chapter 6. Gehazi went out early in the morning, it says, and I'm only saying he went to get the paper. I don't know what else he might have been doing. But he went out there, and he looked around, and he was scared to death because he saw Naaman's army, the Syrian army, which was the big army of the day, like tanks, like all around, you know, except it was chariots, but that's tanks in those days, all around on the hills, just scaring him to death. And he came running back in. What's going to happen? And Elisha says, get a life, Gehazi. Take your meds. Lord, just open his eyes and let him see. That's all Elisha said. Lord, open his eyes and let him see. He said, listen, there's more with us than there are with them. And Gehazi must have looked at him like, huh? And he says, open his eyes and let him see. And he did. For a moment, the Lord allowed Gehazi to see the angels. And there were angels all around that city. And there are many stories, which I won't tell you. You've heard probably half a dozen of them yourself, stories from the mission field and even from the U.S. of people who insist that they have had a glimpse of angelic protection. Interestingly, when Jesus was being questioned on the last night of his life, and or when he was being arrested, and his men tried to defend him, he said, "Hey, stop it. Don't you think that all I'd have to do, don't you understand, all I'd have to do is ask my Father, and he would send more than 12, he says, 12 legions of angels would take care of me." He says, "This is, you don't need to do this." Why? Because Jesus was very aware of angelic protection. It was there. And you need to be aware of it too. If it helps you to simply even imagine in your mind's eye what's right on the other side of what we perceive tonight, then do that, but realize they're there. Now, the Lord allowed Jacob to see this, I am convinced, so that he would have courage. I'm not sure how much courage Jacob took from this, but I do believe that the Lord allowed him to see these angels on purpose and to realize, look, there's not just one camp here. It's not just you and your family alone in the wilderness. It is two camps. It's you and your family in the wilderness, but you are not alone. The angels are around you. I am here, and I know what I'm doing. And besides which, Jacob had no place else to go anyway. It wasn't like he could run away. He had to go to Canaan. There was no two ways about it. And so the Lord comes. He lets him see these things. Verses 3 down through verse 8. Jacob figures he better send some guys to talk to Esau, find out what's going on. Now, this from now on, down through the end of the chapter, it's pretty much all preparation for him to meet Esau. And the preparation takes basically four phases. There's this realization, and it shocks him even more than he expected. We'll see what it is, this fearful realization. And then there's a real focused prayer. And fear has a way of focusing your prayer wonderfully, verses 9 to 12. And then there's a final plan. It's his last effort to do the best he could to try and make it work out right. And then there's a faithful struggle. And you know how that goes. So let's begin in verse 3 with the actual preparation. This is all preparation for Jacob, for him to meet Esau. Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he commanded them, and he said, "Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I've been with Uncle Laban all this time. And I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants. And I have sent to tell my lord that I may find favor in your sight." What he's doing is he's sending his little buddy out there for two reasons, or a little group out there for a couple reasons. Notice what he's telling his brother. I have plenty of stuff. What do you think he means? What do you think he's trying to get across to Esau? That he's not after Esau's stuff. And he's going to, actually, that's very much part of his plan to get that point across to Esau. Because what was it that Esau and Jacob had fought over before? Stuff, of course. They fought over lots of stuff. They were very stuff-oriented guys. And he says, now I've got plenty of stuff. And I know you've got all my old stuff too. So, you know, would it be okay if we were just friends? That's the idea. But he also wants to find out from his men who go and visit with Esau. He wants to find out what Esau's thinking. Well, what he finds out is not the news he wanted. First of all, he sends them to Seir, which is a long way south. But they don't have to go all that far. They don't have to go all that far to find him. The messengers returned to Jacob and said, "We came to your brother Esau, and furthermore, he's coming to meet you." We met him. He's on his way. "And 400 men are with him." And Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. And he divided the people who were with him and the flocks and the herds and the camels into two companies. And he said, "If Esau comes to the one company and attacks it, then the other company, which is left, will escape." Can you imagine having to divide your family up into two groups, thinking perhaps one group would die, and figuring it would take long enough to attack that group to let the other half get away and live? That's how scared Jacob is at this point. Apparently, the men who went and visited Esau didn't come back with good enough communication from Esau. You know, if Esau had said, "Hey, you know, I'm really like, I've been missing Jake, and I'm looking forward to seeing him, and I'm really glad he's coming," they would have told Jacob that, and it would have been a lot better. It's obvious they didn't say this to Jacob, which means that Esau either didn't say anything, or what he did say was not helpful to Jacob's fear okay? Plus the fact that he's got 400 guys with him, and this was not like a welcome home thing that he was bringing, a mobile party to say, thank you, Jacob, for coming home. And so, now on the other hand, what would Esau, what would you be thinking if you were Esau? What would you be thinking if you're Esau? You're coming, you hear your brother's coming, and you apparently have gotten word already. Word kind of goes around, right? Because you're on your way, and you meet a couple of his guys, and you got your 400 guys there. And the last time you saw Jacob, he stole from you and had ripped you off really, really badly. Plus, you know that legally and spiritually and morally, he is, it's really the legal owner of everything you have. You've been kind of babysitting all of Grandpa's stuff for the last 20 years. But it actually belongs to Jacob, and everybody knows it. And Isaac's not dead yet, by the way. So Isaac would have stood behind that too. Interesting. What would you think if you were Esau? Well, you'd probably figure, I better go out there with armed men. I better be prepared to protect myself. The last time I saw my crook of a brother, he had taken advantage of me. Now I find out he's got all this stuff, all these people. He might be coming to take the rest of everything. This might be the end of the Monopoly game for me. So I'm going to take my guys out there, and I'm going to take care of this. It's an interesting thing that the seeds of dishonesty grow into trees of distrust. When you are dishonest with people that are closest to you over a long period of time, silently, distrust develops and defensiveness develops, and it does not help anything. And that's exactly what happened. See, Jacob sowed the seeds of what he was going back to harvest right now. And clear back, his last communication with Esau was so bad, he should have expected nothing. Oh, well, he did expect nothing less. He expected Esau to come after him. And you know something? If I'd have been Esau, I might have, he hadn't read the story. I might have done the same thing. When you sow dishonesty, you will reap distrust. You won't necessarily reap dishonesty. You'll reap distrust when you sow dishonesty. When you commit crimes against other people, they will not trust you. And you've got to know that they won't trust you. Trust is built very slowly with small deeds done one after another after another. Small promises kept over a long period of time. This is what develops trust. When the trust is broken, it doesn't take much to cut down a tree that took 30 years to grow. Those seeds will grow up into something you don't want. So if you're in the habit of living off of other people like Jacob used to be, don't be surprised if they don't trust you anymore. And if you're in a situation where you're not trusted and you're saying, those people should trust me, I said I was sorry, you know what you might do? You might do what Jacob did. Try and make up for it. Now, as it turns out, the Lord was in this. But Jacob realized, I ripped Esau off. I know I did. Now, something's really happened inside of him, and he really tries to rebuild some trust. We see that that's part of his plan, which I think was a good thing for him to do and not a bad thing. But we'll get to that in just a minute. Anyway, so Esau comes, and he's got 400 guys, and Jacob's scared to death, and Jacob divides his family up, and he's thinking, this might be the last time I see at least half of my family. Major trauma for this man, Jacob. He does not know how this is going to turn out. Verse 9, Jacob said, now this is, he goes immediately to prayer. O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who did say to me, return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. Remember, you're the one who sent me out here. I am unworthy of all the loving kindness, of all the faithfulness which you've shown to your servant. For with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. He's looking out at these two huge groups that are really all his. And he goes to pray, maybe went up on a hill or something, and he's praying, and he looks out, and he looks at this old staff that he's had for 20 years that he remembers using as a hiking stick when he first came to Paddan Aram. He says, this is the only thing I had when I came here. Look at this, Lord. Look at what you've done. Man, it was just 20 years ago, all I had was this staff, and now look at all that you've done. Lord, would you please do one more thing for me? Verse 11, deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother. From the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me, the mothers with the children. You can tell what's on his mind. It's the families he's afraid for. He sees these kids being slaughtered. And they could have been, they could easily have been in those days. For you did say, I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. You remember these things, Lord? Look at how focused this prayer is. He's got a real knowledge of who God is, and he's trying his best to do what he said. And there's a lot of power in that. When you really know the Lord, you know you have a covenant with him, and you're trying your best to do what he says. That gives you tremendous confidence in prayer, especially when there's a crisis. When you're really in a crisis and things are really falling apart, you fall on your knees and you just say, Lord, we're okay, right? I mean, I belong to you. You belong to me. You're the one who's brought me this far, right, Lord? That's exactly what he's doing. And this doesn't happen every single day. You don't go through this every single day. You don't have this kind of intense prayer every day. You have it when you have a crisis. And you don't have to create a crisis every day to have a devotional time like this. These come once in a while when they're needed, and he needs it. So he cries out to the Lord. Covenant knowledge, and also notice the humility in the prayer. I have nothing that I can trade with you. I don't deserve a thing you've given me. I came here with nothing, and you know what, Lord? You've just given it to me. I just came. I didn't do anything. You even caught me on the way, and you said you're going to bless me, and you have. You have totally blessed me. He relies on that. Total humility. I've got nothing to trade, Lord. I've got nothing to trade. And that's a good thing to remember in prayer, too. I have nothing to trade. Don't make foolish promises to God. If you'll do this for me, well, then I'll just do that for you, too, Lord. So, you know, I'll trade you. I'll trade you labor. Like he needs my labor. No, Lord, I cannot offer you anything. I am throwing myself on your mercy. Would you please just deliver me? Please take care of me. And here's the third thing, bold confidence. He gets right to the point. He does not beat around the bush, does not butter the Lord up, does not try and, you know, kiss up a little bit in the prayer time in order to get God to like him again and then maybe give him what he wants. He comes straight to the point. And you know why? He says, deliver me from my brother. I'm scared of him. Real blunt. I'm afraid he's going to attack me and kill my family. Very straight, very specific, very bold, very blunt. Where does that come from? It comes from knowing the Lord. It comes from knowing who he is and being real specific about what you would like to see him do in a crisis. It's exactly what he does. If you have a covenant and you're coming in humility, you can come with real confidence and you can ask for whatever's on your mind. Well, after the prayer, and we don't know where or how or anything of what happened during that prayer time, and there's no indicator that an angel came and talked to him at that time. You know, if he'd seen angels before, you would expect maybe if you went out to prayer that one might show up. That isn't what happened. He prayed, that was it. So he spent the night there, verse 13, and he selected from what had been with him as a present for his brother Esau. 200 female goats and 20 male goats and 200 ewes and 20 rams and 30 milking camels, and their colts, 40 cows, 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys, 10 male donkeys. And this isn't everything. This is a big ranch. Any of you folks have livestock? Camels? You guys got camels? I don't blame you for not having camels. 30 camels. Do you know how many people it takes to take care of all these animals? This is a guy with a lot of stuff. Well, they're camels and their colts. Verse 16. And he delivered them into the hand of his servants, and every drove by itself. He divided them up into groups, and he said to the servants, pass on before me and put a space between the droves. So he's got them all spaced out. You guys probably know the story, but in case you don't, what he did is he had them all in these groups so that one at a time they would kind of come upon his brother Esau. He sent them all off there, first one, then another, then another. Kind of like if you're doing a wedding, you know, and the bridesmaids are walking down and first one gets down to halfway through and then the next one starts, right? And on. Okay, well, that's what he's doing with these groups of animals and stuff. So if you were to look at it from the air, and you flew over the area, here's Jacob and here's Esau. They can't see each other. There's a bunch of land between them. They're heading toward each other. And Jacob says, I'm going to send these groups. And there's these groups of animals and people that are moving. And then there's a space and there's another group, right? And so he's hoping that his brother Esau is going to see all of this and be really glad. He sends them all out there. It's going to take him a while to get there. So he sends them all out. And they're traveling during the night or during the following days. And he tells him this in verse 17, when Esau meets you and asks you, and he says, to whom do you belong, and where are you going, and to whom do these animals in front of you belong? He sent the animals first, incidentally. He made them go behind the, he made the people go behind the animals. He wanted the animals out front. The reason is because the animals were extremely valuable, and he wanted to impress Esau a little bit with this, with these animals, because this is money on the hoof in those days. When these folks saw animals coming, that was like you seeing cash coming. I mean, you know, that's what would be going on in their mind, and that's exactly what he wants Esau to see, the value of what's coming. Verse 18, then you tell him this, these belong to your servant Jacob. And it is a present sent to my lord Esau, and behold, he is behind us. So every one of you are going to say this when you get to, you say, these are from Jacob, they're a present for Esau, and Jacob is way back there, and he's coming. So Jacob is saying, I'm just going to soften this guy up. I'm going to send so much good stuff his way. See? That's what he's doing. And he commanded also the second and the third and all those who followed the droves and said, after this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him. And you shall say, behold, your servant Jacob also is behind us. Everybody tell the same thing. Jacob's coming. Jacob's coming. And then another gift. And just when he thinks, oh, well, there was one. Oh, two. Oh, three. And he keeps, they, you know, he's really kind of going overboard here. Verse 20. And you shall say, behold, your servant Jacob is also behind me. Because he's saying to himself, Jacob says to himself, I'm going to appease him with the present that goes before me. And then afterward, I'm going to see his face and perhaps he will accept me. So the present passed on before him while he himself spent the night in the camp. So he sent everybody out. Now, most folks, I don't know if you guys read in devotional commentaries and stuff, most people will read this story, or many people read this story, and they'll say Jacob was really his old self here. He's trying to bribe Esau. This is possible. I suppose it is possible that he was trying to do this in the arm of the flesh and all that stuff and trying to figure out a way to do it. But you know something? I really don't, I'm not going to get on his case about it. First of all, God doesn't get on his case about it. God has a higher opinion of Jacob, really, than a lot of commentators do. And you know something? I think Jacob knew in his heart that he had ripped Esau off and he was trying to do the best he could to make his real motives now known. He was really trying, even going way overboard, to let the change in his heart be known so that Esau, who had a legitimate beef, a very legitimate beef with him, so that Esau would say, well, you know, maybe Jacob means better now than he did in those days. I don't think Jacob's doing the wrong thing. I actually think it was the best he could do. And sometimes God calls upon us to do the best we can do. It may seem like a little too late, but he calls upon us to do the best we can. And it was certainly expensive. I don't know how much of his substance he sent. He may have sent almost all of it except for his actual immediate family. We don't know, but he sent a lot of it. So this was his final plan. It's his last-ditch effort. He's putting everything out there. And he arose at verse 22, and he arose that night and took his two wives and his two maids and his 11 children, and he crossed the ford of the Jabbok. And he took them, and he sent them across the stream, and he sent across whatever he had. So that left him on the other side of the Jabbok Creek or the Jabbok River by himself. And this must have been, well, it was when the angel came and met him, but one of these absolutely lonely times when it is just you and God. That's exactly what's going on here. I'm not sure whether Jacob went out and began to pray again and the Lord came to him, or whether Jacob was just beside himself and the Lord just appeared without being asked. I don't know, but I do know, and we all know, that God came to him. Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. Can you imagine this? How? What would that be like? It's nighttime. Jacob is there. His heart is already rent. I mean, he has no idea how things are going to turn out. He may lose his whole family, may lose everything. He goes out with God, and there's this wrestling match. How did it start? What would it have been like to have a person, what did he do, just come up and grab him? You know, or did Jacob show up and all of a sudden, you know, there's a wrestling mat right there, you know, and 3 points for a takedown, you know, and they just kind of go for it there. Who knows how it happened or how it started? I wonder if the Lord came up and just pushed him. You say, no, he wouldn't. Really? Are you sure he wouldn't? Are you sure he wouldn't walk up and say, who do you trust? Jake. And knowing Jacob, Jacob says, I'm not in the mood for this. Back off. Oh, yeah? Boom, bam. Was that what it was like? I don't know. But it was physical. It was real. It wasn't just a dream. It wasn't just a vision. That was a real wrestling match. And it calls him a man. The angel of the Lord is sometimes referred to as a man because he looks like one. Verse 25. And when he saw that he had not prevailed against him, what's being said here is that the man wrestled with him. In other words, it does indicate that the angel of the Lord is who picked the fight, which is, I think, fascinating. And they wrestled, verse 25. And when he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh, so that the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. Now, the only way that we can possibly know what happened is Jacob must have told this story, because only two of them were there. So Jacob must have told this story and written it down for his family, and that's how we ended up getting it. But it's amazing, and it's kind of cheating, don't you think, in a wrestling match, to just say, well, I'm not winning. Boink. I'll just dislocate your thigh. I mean, those of you who did a little wrestling would like to have that power, wouldn't you? You know, like you'd go all the way to the state and the nation, you know, if you could do that to everybody that ever wrestled you, you'd know who they were. They were all limping after. Just a fascinating thing. It's just an amazing, we're so used to hearing this story since we're kids that the real grown-up realities of it are astounding. Astounding, first of all, that this angel cared enough to come and pick a fight with Jacob because Jacob needed it. God comes and says, I'm picking a fight with you because you need it. That is just amazing. I'm picking a fight with you because you need it. And then to wrestle all night in human strength to human strength, limiting himself, the Lord was, purposely. Why? At any minute he could have just laid him out. Of course, obviously, because when it came right down to it, he purposely crippled him. Why? To see how long Jacob would hold on? To see if Jacob would figure out what was going on? I don't know. He said, let me go. He crippled him, and then he said, let me go. The dawn is breaking. He said, I'm not going to let you go unless you bless me. Jacob's going, you know, you're going to have to do something for me. I am not letting you. What was he hanging on? His leg? He's laying on the ground, hanging on to the angel of the Lord's leg. I am not letting you. Are you kidding me? I am not letting you out of my sight. I'm laying here, pal. You did it. You got to do something good for me now. You got to bless me. And the fact that he asks this indicates he knows who he's wrestling with now. Now, whether he knew in the very beginning, we don't know. But he knew now that the person who had crippled him was God. In some way, he knew. And he says, I am not going to let you go unless you bless me. And he said, what's your name? And he said, Jacob. And he wasn't saying, you know, I forget. What's your name? He wanted Jacob to be reminded that his name meant supplanter. He says, tell me your name out loud. That's what the Lord's saying. What's your name? What's your identity? Supplanter, the struggler, the supplanter, the guy who, as long back as he could remember, had been wrestling around for an advantage with anybody he could wrestle with. His brother, his family, Laban, I got to get an advantage. I got to get a blessing. I got to win. I got to wrestle. I got to fight. Whatever it takes, I got to have what I got to have. That's supplanter. What's your name? Supplanter. Except now I'm crippled and I can't wrestle anymore. He said, okay, I'm going to change your name. You'll no longer be Jacob. You're going to be Israel. For you have striven with God. That's what Israel means, the one who strives with God, and with men. And you have prevailed. Very interesting. I'm going to change your name to Israel. For those of you who don't know, most of you do, but perhaps you don't know that this is where Israel got its name. This is where the nation of Israel got its name. It was because of Jacob. So people say, how did they become the Israelites? It's because from now on, this family is called the family of Israel, and it's a transformed name. It's a reborn, new kind of identity. And it goes, the children of Israel and the tribes of Israel, you see, all get their name from here. The one who strives with God, the one who used to be a crook, but has been striving with God, and the one whom God crippled and changed his name, and this was how he blessed him. He gave him a new name and revealed his destiny, really, to him. You've wrestled with God and with men, you've prevailed. And Jacob asked him and said, what's your name? Now, that's pretty bold. Oh, well, tell me your name. And he wouldn't tell him. Why are you asking my name? And he blessed him there. Can you imagine that scene? Jacob's hanging onto his leg. You know, I'm not letting go. What's your name? Jacob. But I'm still not letting go. Okay, I'm changing your name to Israel. Oh, wow, cool. What's your name? He says. He's still holding on. And the Lord says, you don't get to know my name. You can really tell who's in charge. That's exactly his point. You don't get to know my name. I get to know your name. Incidentally, in those days, more than it is today, just the ability to know somebody's name meant you knew them, and the ability to command, what's your name, in those days, meant a lot. To know somebody's name was a personal thing. He says, you don't get to know my name. Very interesting. So Jacob named the place. He blessed him there, and then finally Jacob let him go. Finally. And Jacob named the place Peniel. He said, because I've seen God face to face and my life has been saved. It's been preserved. Peniel means the face of God. Now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Peniel, slight change in the name there. It's the same place. And he was limping on his thigh. Therefore, to this day, the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh in the sinew of the hip. So when they would slaughter their animals in those days, they would leave a piece out, and they wouldn't cook it. And the reason was, out of deference to what God had done, they never forgot what had happened. And we'll stop there, because I knew we wouldn't have enough time to do chapter 33 entire. Well, actually, you know what? I'm going to breeze 33. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to just tell you the story, and then you'll find out what happened. Jacob went to Esau. Esau fell on his neck, which is a nice thing, and they cried to each together. He came in there. Look at just the first verse. Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau was coming with his 400 men with him, and he divided up. Jacob still divides up the children. He's still scared. He put them all in front of him. He wanted him to see the whole family. But he himself passed on ahead and then bowed down to the ground seven times until he came near his brother. So he'd come up and he'd bow down. Then he'd walk a little further and bow down. And Esau ran up to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him. And they wept. And he lifted his eyes and he saw the women and the children. What happened at that point is essentially this. Esau said, what is all this? And what is all this that I have that you've sent me? And Jacob says, well, it's presents for you, man. I just wanted to give it to you. Esau says, I don't need it, man. I got plenty. Jacob says, please take it. Esau says, okay. He did. That's exactly what happened. Esau says, man, it's really good to see you. This is exactly the opposite of what Jacob expected, and it is a complete answer to his prayers, absolute answer to his prayers. And Esau says, come with me. And Jacob says, you know, I got a lot of family with me, and I got a lot of stuff. We got to go slow, plus I'm limping now. And so you go on back home, and I'll just catch up later. And so after some time and after a great reunion, they did that. They parted company. Jacob ended up with all of his stuff left. Esau went back to all of his stuff. And Jacob went and stayed in Sukkot and then in Shechem. And that's where we'll pick up his story later. And we'll talk more about that next time. What I want to point out is God totally, totally took away what was this horrible, fearful thing that Jacob had been facing. He totally took it away. Now, the question is this. If you're Jacob, or you're watching the thing, do you think that it happened because Jacob sent a bunch of animals out there? Or do you think it happened because of prayer? All those in favor of prayer, raise your hand. All those in favor of animals, raise your hand. We had a couple of folks who were saying, I think he really wanted the animals. I think the animals really worked. You want to know something? Isn't it interesting how sometimes you don't know how God did what he did? Was it just the prayer? Would it have worked if he hadn't sent the animals? Did you ever do something that you felt was needed in the situation, then afterward, after God answered the prayer, you thought, you know, I could have done that a lot cheaper? Have you ever thought to yourself, well, you know, I kind of gave away too much on that situation. This kind of went easier than I thought it was going to. You know, I could have got away with a little less of personal sacrifice in this situation. Do you ever have that happen? You know, God doesn't tell us. And I just love that. He just doesn't tell us. You say, well, it seems like kind of a coincidence. Well, that's, remember that old saying, when I pray, coincidences happen, and when I don't, they don't. So, if it's a coincidence, it's a coincidence. I don't know if it was the plan that Jacob made or if it was just the prayer. I'm certain the prayer was part of it. But maybe the prayer was part of the plan. Who knows? Who knows? It doesn't really matter. The point is, God did it. God did it. You know, I think we can learn some things, and I'll close with these, about this whole crisis that he's going through here. First, God orchestrated the whole thing, you can tell. First of all, he told him to leave Paddan Aram in the first place. Secondly, the angels appeared to him as he's going along just before the thing appears. So that obviously we're supposed to remember by reading it, we're supposed to say, hey, God set this whole thing up. This whole critical issue that is so frightening and so terrible was set up by the Lord for a purpose. And notice that it wasn't to punish Jacob. He's not rebuking Jacob, but he is training Jacob. Jacob still has growth, and that's really what's going on here. Jacob himself needs to be changed into Israel. And the only way it's going to happen, first of all, is if he has a big enough life that it's a threat to him. When your life is real small and all you own is a staff, losing the staff's not that big a deal. But when your life is really, really big and you got everything Jacob had, God says, okay, now I've got you where I can really do something in your life because there's some real loss that can occur. Let me see. Let me wrestle with you about this, you see. God set this whole thing up from the very beginning, and we're meant to understand that. We're meant to read the story. You can tell by how it reads. We are meant to see that God set it up, and yet we're not supposed to see exactly how God solved it all, only that he did solve it. And we're supposed to see how Jacob trusted him. Secondly, notice that God initiated the struggle, which resulted in Jacob's blessing. I don't know if many people picked it out, but in verses 24 and 25, like I mentioned, God's the one who first pushed Jacob in the wrestling match. God picked a fight with him. And the interesting thing is when God picks a fight, there's always a reason for it. When he picks a fight with one of his people, and this is what I wanted to point out, when he picks a fight with one of his people, his purpose is to bless. He initiated the struggle, which resulted in Jacob's blessing. If you're wrestling with God right now, I guarantee you his intention is to bless. It may involve some pain, and it may involve some limping, but his purpose is to bless, so that you will limp in the right direction. And that's exactly what happened to Jacob. From here on, he limps in the right direction. And here's the third thing I've noticed in here, is that God lamed Jacob, and Jacob was blessed by hanging on to him while he did it. That's how it happened. How did he prevail? Well, he didn't pin him. Hello. Jacob did not win this wrestling match by pinning the Lord. You know, and making him do, you're going to bless me or I won't let you up. That's not exactly how it turned out. Well, then how could God say he prevailed? Well, he prevailed by hanging on while God weakened him. Now, that's an odd way to prevail, isn't it? It's an odd way to win. Jesus said, if you seek to save your life, you'll lose it. If you lose it to me, you'll win. Isn't that great? That you win by hanging on while God weakens you, while he takes away stuff you thought you needed, while he changes everything, and then you find out all I've got is you, and I cannot let go of you. I will not let go of you now, especially. I will not let go of you, ever. God says, that's what I've been waiting for. That's what we've always needed to know, isn't it? And then, congratulations, you won the wrestling match. You're hanging on to me. That's the whole point. Turn to Hosea. That's where this is actually explained, believe it or not. Hosea chapter 12. Hosea is in the Minor Prophets. It's right after the book of Daniel. So find the book of Daniel, and then right after that is Hosea. Daniel's right after Ezekiel, and Ezekiel's real big, so chances are you'll find Ezekiel if you keep looking. And then you'll find Daniel right after that, you see, and then after that is Hosea. You got to find the big ones first, right, and know where the little ones are. Hosea 12, many, many years later, of course, hundreds of years, maybe even, what, close to 1,200 years, I think off the top of my head, in terms of history, later, the first six verses of Hosea 12, Hosea is a prophet. He's speaking to northern Israel, which is also named Ephraim. That's the other name for northern Israel. Now, we're talking about the land of Israel, not just the people, but we're talking about the people in the land to the north who are terribly disobedient to God, and this is a prophecy against them, but I want you to see what it. I want you to see it in light of Jacob's wrestling match. Ephraim feeds on wind and pursues the east wind continually. He multiplies lies and violence. Moreover, he makes a covenant with Assyria, and oil is carried to Egypt. He's rebuking northern Israel for trading and thinking they can buy themselves out of trouble by dealing with Assyria. He says it's a waste of time. God told him this. If you know your Jewish history, God told him this over and over again. Don't deal with the enemy. Don't make deals with the enemy. Trust me. But they wouldn't do it. So he's rebuking him for that. The Lord also has a dispute with Judah, the southern kingdom, and will punish Jacob according to his ways. Jacob's another word for Israel, remember? Whenever you see it in the prophets, Jacob just means Israel. And now we know why, right? We know why. Because they're both the same guy. I will punish Jacob according to his ways, and he will repay him according to his deeds. Now look at this. Speaking of Jacob, now the prophecy moves into the history, which you know now. In the womb, he took his brother by the heel. Jacob took his brother by the heel. And in his maturity, he contended with God. See, he was a struggler from the beginning, he says. And now, Hosea, speaking to Ephraim 1,200 years later, says, you've always been a struggler. Learn a lesson from the guy who gave you your name. Learn a lesson from the old struggler himself. Awesome. He even contended with God. Yes, he wrestled with the angel and prevailed. That, of course, he's taking straight out of the Pentateuch, where we just read it in Genesis. And he wept and sought his favor. Very interesting. Hanging on. You can just hear him. Hanging on to the angel. I'm not going to let you go. You got to bless me. He wept and sought his favor. And he found him at Bethel, and there he spoke with us. Meaning the Lord had found Jacob at Bethel. That was the first place they met. Even the Lord, the God of hosts, the Lord is his name. Therefore, return to your God. Observe kindness and justice and wait for your God continually. Stop there. You see the message? The message is this. You win by returning to your God and by hanging on. And he uses Jacob as the prophetic picture of it. He said, Jacob won by just hanging on to the Lord and trusting him. And he says, you'll do the same thing. It is true that God picked the fight, but it was for Jacob's good, and Jacob won by holding on. And you know, my friend, you may be feeling right now like, you know, that's all I've got. That's all I've got is you to hang on to, Lord. You know, that's not a bad place to be. You may be actually winning right now in a way far deeper than you've ever won before in your life. Because when all you've got to hang on to is the Lord, and you hang on to him, and you let him take you in the direction he's taken you, it is amazing what he will do. Let's bow our heads. Father, thank you for your faithfulness. Thank you for this account in Jacob's life, such a famous, well-known account. And yet, Lord, what an odd thing that you should come and, in a sense, pick a fight with a chosen man that you love for the purpose of crippling him so that you can bless him and making him realize that his only life is hanging on to you. My Father, help us to understand this and help us to hang on to you, because you are our life. Many things assail our minds. Many crises swirl around us in this world and in our own personal lives. but we hold on to you like Jacob, crippled and hanging on to the one person who will bless him. And we know that, Lord, this is your design. We know that your purpose in wrestling with us is to bless. We thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.